right, I want to welcome everyone to the Second Court of Appeals. We have one case on our 10:30 docket, Acadia Healthcare versus Horizon Health Corporation. I believe all the parties have checked in with our clerk, and if the clerk will please announce who's going to be arguing for the parties in the Acadia versus Horizon. All right. Mr. Nobles.
Thank you, Judge Livingston, and may it please the court. I am Jeff Nobles. At council table is Kelly Leonard of my firm. Also here today are the lawyers who helped try the case, Bill Wood and Grace Weatherly from the Denton firm of Wood, Thacker, and Weatherly. Probably more than 20 years ago, a very smart and talented Texas appellate lawyer suggested to me that every case is really about one thing, and oral argument is the chance where we talk about that one thing and the time that we have. In 15 minutes, there's not much time to talk about two things. This case involves really one thing, and that is that under Texas law, an employee is free to leave their employer and compete for new customers without limitations, and compete for their employer's existing customers with certain limitations, which are governed by the Texas Covenant Not to Compete Act. And the court's aware that the Covenant Not to Compete Act preempts pre-existing law on competition. And it says there's only three things that parties can do in terms of a covenant not to compete to limit that default rule that there's a constitutional right to compete. Those three things are they can impose reasonable time limitations, reasonable geographical limitations, and reasonable limitations on the scope of activity. A case cited in our brief, a first court case written by Judge Evelyn Kies, called Abetter, is often cited because Judge Kies did a nationwide survey, and particularly a Texas survey of the cases, collecting them. And those cases recognize that in Texas, to resign from employment and compete with your employer is a constitutional right. That statement is at 113 Southwest 3rd, 503 at 510, and it collects and cites other Texas cases. I want to talk about this issue, this one thing, in the context of Section 15.50, and I want to talk first about the business interests that are protected subject to 15.50. And the business interest was written on by the Supreme Court in 1991, a case called Pete Marwick versus Haas, 818 Southwest 2nd, 381. That case recognized that the limitations of Section 1550 are designed to protect the legitimate business interests of the employer. And it wrote, Judge Gamage wrote the opinion. It wrote at length on what Texas courts and what courts around the country have held that legitimate business interest is. And that business interest is kind of like the employer's goodwill. It can be protected under Texas law by restrictions on taking only existing clients. It is never reasonable under Texas law to prevent an employee from leaving their employer and going to look for new clients using their skill and their talents, their own individual talents, to find new clients to expand the marketplace. Texas cases have recognized that Texas favors economic competition. Competition encourages innovation. Innovation encourages efficiency, better prices, better products. Those are all enshrined by the Texas constitutional protection for what the defendants in this case were sued for doing and assessed a judgment in excess of $6 million. In Pete Marwick, the court called it a protectable interest. Only a protectable interest can be subject to regulation. There's in that those facts are relevant to this case. I want to talk about the facts of this case very quickly. Five individual employees, very experienced, very talented managers and officers of Horizon, had worked there for decades. In previous decades, in the 1990s and in the 2000 and aughts, they had signed, four of them had signed non-compete agreements that did not contain geographical limitations. Instead, they prohibited four of those employees, the four who signed non-competes, from competing directly or indirectly.
I understand that your position is that these non-competition agreements are not valid or enforceable for multiple reasons.
That is correct.
But three of them are pretty much the same.
Right.
Mr. Yelasowicz.
That's right.
Perhaps. His is a bit different, and his is more confined, maybe not geographically, but a more client-based restriction, which case law has approved. So my question of you is, hypothetically, if this court were to find that agreement and that agreement alone was enforceable, how would that affect all the other issues in this case?
It would make the case a whole lot simpler, even if the court were to hold that, because the real key to this case is that none of the defendants ever took an existing customer from Horizon. Horizon's own experts testified, Mr. Devaney, and their expert witness, they all testified that we didn't lose any customers to them. We're looking for future lost profits based on hypothetical customers that Mr. Pachocki, the sales rep who did not have a non-compete, on hypothetical customers that he might bring in. What Mr. Yelasowicz,
there seems to be a dispute as to whether Westlake was an existing customer. Sometimes in reading y'all's briefs, I really wondered whether you were at the same trial or not, because I mean, they're just so opposed as to evidence, objections that were made, preservation of error. You're just, you know, it's hard to know what's right without having to read the record completely, which it will be done.
It is hard, and I apologize for the size of the record, Judge Gabriel. Our reply brief summarizes the evidence regarding Westlake, and there's a section at the beginning of the response to the statement of facts filed by Acadia that corrects numerous statements that Acadia's response brief said, I'm sorry, Horizon's response brief said about whether Westlake was an existing customer. It's undisputed that Westlake was not an existing customer. It's also undisputed that Westlake was not on a master accounts list, an active leads list at the time these folks left. Mr. Yelasowicz, his non-compete does prohibit him from competing with clients or customers who are on that master accounts list. And it's undisputed that he did not interfere with any accounts that were on a master accounts list. None of the defendants did. The only activity that they undertook in the year after they left this former company and before trial, the only activity they undertook was to sign five new contracts. One of them was Westlake. The other four, no dispute that there was no connection to Horizon. And Westlake was also unconnected to Horizon, as our reply brief summarizes. The only evidence that I've seen in the record is Mr. Jack Devaney's vague recollection that he thinks that they were on a lead list at some time. But he admitted at trial, his testimony was corrected on cross-examination to state that it was not, in fact, on an active lead list. And there's nothing more than a vague recollection, nothing more than speculation that it was ever on a lead list at all. Even so, under Texas law, because it was not an existing customer, it's not a customer that was taken. And that Westlake contract is $898,000 in speculative future profits out of a $4.2 million award. The other $3.3 million is based on this damage model. An expert who said, "This is my estimate of what will happen." That was his summary of what he did. And he said that we have calculated that Mr. Pachocki was going to bring in six new contracts for each of the next 2 to 4 years. An average salesman brings in 4, so he has a marginal value of 2 new contracts every year. We're going to play out the assumption that he was going to do that in the next 4 to 6 years, or next 2 to 4 years, and we're going to play out a scenario over 15 years that generates the numbers that they wanted of total lost profits in the future of $4.2 million. All of that is based on hypothetical customers. It's not based on existing customers. And I want to refer to this court's opinion in the Gooden case written by Judge Livingston in 2008. That case involved a non-compete that was functionally identical to the 3 other than Mr. Yelosiewicz's in this case. They prohibited the employees from entering into competition without a limitation as to geographic scope. And this court held that that restriction was overbroad, just as the one in this case is. It said that this agreement does not purport to restrict the employees from competing only with respect to the employer's then current customers, which this court might have enforced. Instead, it purports to restrict the employee from starting a competing business without any limitations as to geographic scope whatsoever.
Well, aren't there some cases that say that when you're in an industry that is such a, so specific, such as this is, the management of psychiatric facilities in hospitals, that it's such a small portion of the industry, that in and of itself is a restriction?
I don't think there's a case that holds that, Judge Gabriel. There are cases that say that you can imply geographic restrictions in other ways, but I'm not aware of a case that says that a non-compete which has a national scope, which prevents workers, individuals from competing with their employer, I'm not aware of a case that says that that's a reasonable restriction. Under the Gooden case, this court specifically held that the statute is enforced as it's written. It's a geographical restriction. And it's not just a technicality, because what we're talking about is the ability of people who have a narrow skill set to practice their skills in competition with their employer. If an employer is able or were able to craft a restrictive covenant that said you can't compete anywhere with me, and I'm going to define what we do in such a narrow way that you can't practice in my business, you're telling these folks that they have to become dishwashers. They have to start over and start a new job. The Texas Constitution, as the Abetter case said, doesn't allow workers to be deprived, individuals to be deprived of the right to practice their talents and skill sets. And our reply brief distinguishes the cases that Horizon cites on this issue. And in my reading of those cases, none of them say that a substitute for a geographical limitation could include a nationwide, industry-wide prohibition. Texas cases have said that an industry-wide prohibition like that is unlawful because it prevents folks from making a living at what they do best. It'd be like telling a lawyer you can't practice law.
Can you go ahead and jump to a little more about the impact on the appellee's perhaps failure to show any lost business or any particular client that was stolen? I perceive that sort of as a causation issue. In other words, there's no relationship between the damages perhaps they're claiming and the fact of the lack of taking clients.
That's right. In our briefing, this is my shorthand. I learned it as a fact of damages argument. If you look at Pete Marwick, 818 Southwest 2nd, 381, Pete Marwick calls it a protectable interest. A company like Horizon does not have a protectable interest in customers that it does not do business with. Its only protectable interest is in its existing customer base. There's nothing that would allow a company to prohibit in a covenant not to compete or to recover damages under a similar theory in contract or in tort for an employee exercising that individual's right to compete for new customers. That employee is opening the marketplace, creating a bigger pie for everyone. If they take existing customers, you wrote in the Gooden case that that might make it a reasonable restriction, but it's not reasonable to cut off the right to develop new customers, particularly new customers in this business in all regions of the country. This is a big country. These defendants, these individual defendants, live in a number of different states. To interpret these non-competes to allow these Horizon to recover damages for customers that Horizon hasn't secured violates Texas law.
Okay, and I have a follow-up question relative to the damage question. And I think one of you all has alluded to it in your briefing. I know we've gone over, so we'll give the other side a little additional time as well. What impact, if any, could there be or should there have been on the amount of damages due to the fact that the agreements, if enforceable, were limited in duration to a one-year time period, whereas the damage testimony went out 2, 4, and I believe up to 15 years?
We didn't brief that issue, but we thought about it. You know, there were a lot of arguments in this case, but we've researched this issue. There are cases from around the country that say that the damages are limited to that period of time, particularly in the context of an at-will employee. Those damages are limited to that period of time before the at-will employee left in those cases. I don't think that issue has been squarely answered or addressed by a court in Texas. There are some Mississippi cases that I found that I could provide to the court in a post-letter brief, post-submission okay. brief, if you'd like.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Judge.
I have a question.
Thank you, Judge.
From a structural standpoint, are all of your issues that you raise, just from a roadmap structural standpoint, would the sustaining of any of them undo the entire judgment, or is it if you address this one, then you have to address that one, or have you structured it such that any one sustaining of any one of your issues causes the whole thing to fall?
I think it's such a mess, it's hard to impose the structure that I would like. We tried to impose some structure on it. And the answer to your question, Judge Walker, is that the lost profits question is really the most important question. The damages in this case, the actual damages are $4.2 million. Every theory of recovery in this case is based on that speculative future profit issue. So sustaining our issue on future profits being speculative does away with almost all of the judgment. There's an additional damage finding of $50,000.
The sanction.
That the plaintiff asked the same question about the value of trade secrets three times. Two times they got a zero, on the third one they got a $50,000 answer. The speculative future profits argument doesn't get rid of the $50,000 question. But the covenant not to compete, the reasonableness of that covenant does do away with that. There's tort theories and there's contract theories. I'd have to think harder about whether the covenant not to compete question does away with all the damages. I think that it does, but I'd want to think about that when I'm sitting down at some time before I tell you for sure.
I totally understand that with a 59-page jury charge. It's quite a hefty.
It was a lot of questions.
Thank you. I appreciate your answer.
Thank you, Judge Walker.
All right. If the clerk will please add an additional 2 minutes to Appellee's time to argue, we may or may not need it, but it will be there if you do.
I do appreciate that, Your Honors. May it please the court. To start by addressing Justice Gabriel's first question, because there is a lot of back and forth about the Westlake lead. As we've covered in our briefing, when Mr. Pachocki, who was the salesman who was at issue and who was solicited, we contend wrongfully, and the jury found wrongfully by the departing defendants below, when he left, just days before he left, Plaintiff's Exhibit 190 below, is an email which he received. And if we look at the court record, I'll give you cites to 8 in the reporter's record, pages 164 and 65, volume 10, pages 206 to 207, and volume 11, pages 106 to 107. The Westlake lead, we concede, was previously on a list, had been taken off a list, I believe, when someone else got the contract. And then Mr. Pachocki, as he is departing, gets another lead before he leaves. And it's part of that information, Your Honors, that he emails to himself just before he leaves. And he knows where he's going. He's going to Acadia. He was solicited to go there by Mr. Ulasewicz, whom, as we know, and just looking at his contract, and this is common to all, but he had a duty not to solicit under that contract as well. So if we look with a broad brush, Your Honors, at just the chronology of the case, because it was, as I told, and I apologize because I failed to introduce trial counsel and my partner, Mr. Victor Vidal, who joins me at the table, who has the battle scars, as well as the CEO of our company, Mr. Devaney, who joins us today from the front row. But as I read the transcript, and I'm also a trial lawyer, this was 9 days of a lot of information through which I know the court is wading. In context, if we start with a better case, and I mean absolutely no pun by this, but we need a better case than A Better Trucking for this court to disturb the jury's award. And the reason for that is very specific. It is certainly permissible, nor would Horizon suggest, nor would I as an officer of the court suggest, that parties should not have the free right to compete. And certainly, I think the reason that businesses flock to Texas and flee elsewhere is because the preparation to compete is certainly something that's acknowledged. Even if that means that you are having meetings with coworkers, even if that means that you are trying to plan your own exit because you're responsible for yourself. But the key here is you can prepare for the marathon, but you can't take the subway, which is exactly what these defendants did. They downloaded information that allowed them to create models that they then plugged into that purloined Westlake bid almost immediately thereafter. And if you're going to take the subway to cheat in the competition, you certainly cannot ask our client to pay for it. And Your Honor, I think what was not emphasized, and I think with good reason in the briefing by Acadia below, is also the fiduciary claims that undergird this judgment. Your Honor's question about invalidating the other non-competes. First of all, I think that the Gooden case can be harmonized and should be harmonized with what the Supreme Court told us in Sheshinoff. And that is that if you have a reasonable substitute for a geographic restriction, the original geographic restrictions made sense because in my 20-plus years of practice, I had a bird's-eye view of that's a one-mile radius around somewhere. Given our highly specialized and mobile culture now, as Your Honor points out, I do think what Sheshinoff was looking at is that there can be reasonable substitutions.
What is the reasonable substitute in the other three other than Mr. Ulasewicz?
Your Honor, I think in the other three, the reasonable substitute is the restriction for dealing with customers that by using the confidential information and where that confidential information would cause them to compete directly against Horizon in the markets where Horizon is.
That's an industry-wide restriction, is it not?
It's not, Your Honor, because the industry would be psychiatric practice. We're talking about a very narrow piece of that industry, which is contract management of psychiatric practices within hospitals. So, for example,
that's an industry in and of itself, is it not?
It is, Your Honor. It's a tiny industry, and I think that's what Your Honor's prior question pointed out, is that to ask these defendants who are bound by the agreements to sit out the non-competes that they signed with respect to that subset of the industry was not unduly restrictive, particularly in light of, and this is the second portion, because we're talking about the CEO, the Senior Vice President of Business Development, the Senior Vice President of Clinical Practice. When you overlay that with the fiduciary duties, then those are the things that I think we have to look at in terms of sustaining the judgment.
Let me ask you the same hypothetical question I asked Mr. Nobles, and that is, if this court, and this is very hypothetical, but if this court were to find that the other three were not enforceable, but Mr. Yelasiewicz's was, what effect does that have on, for example, Arcadia's liability?
Well, Your Honor, I think that point, respectfully, I disagree with the opposing counsel. I don't think that affects Acadia's liability, nor do I think it affects the liability of the other co-defendants on the breaches of fiduciary duty, nor do I think it affects Mr. Pachocki's, the finding on him under the breach of fiduciary duty, because remember that it's Mr. Yelasiewicz who solicited Mr. Pachocki. And so if Mr. Yelasiewicz had a non-compete and non-solicitation agreement that is valid, then much of the harm flows from that. If we're talking about, and I don't mean to stray from the court's question, but we find these things overlapping. If we're talking about simple non-competition, then the question, and I think this is the question the jury grappled with as I read the transcript, if you have a non-compete, and these folks all behaved as though they had valid non-competes. There's the language in the email from Mr. Yelasiewicz where he says, we need to keep this discreet. And respectfully, he spelled it wrong, but we knew what he meant. He waived Mr. Palis's non-compete in writing. He took the file, and the evidence shows that he took the file to basically, and forgive the vernacular here, to doctor that agreement, and said, I'm waiving the non-compete. If it wasn't a valid non-compete, why did it require waiver? We know that back when these individuals were considering something they called Project Shamrock, before United Health made the purchase, they spoke to Mr. Devaney, who's now the CEO, and they all specifically declined to give him a non-compete. And the reason was because if it didn't work out, they didn't want him to be stranded there because of the non-compete. So they all recognized that their non-competes were valid. And we think the jury saw that in the testimony that came out. And they also had fiduciary duties. You know, one of the things that comes up with non-competes so frequently is, we are before you all litigating what happened after someone left. And here we are in the position of litigating what happened while they were still there. These defendants admitted at trial and admit as appellants on appeal that they had these meetings to discuss their new venture and then expense them to Horizon. That is an inflammatory fact for any jury. And in looking at the totality of the findings, you will see that they had, I mean, that is, Your Honors, with all due respect, gall. That is asking for us to pay for the subway token. They also, in as far back as October of 2010, before the sale was completed and before the new entity was in place, Mr. Saul, the CEO, did two things that you'll see in the record. Plaintiff's Exhibit 464, and in Volume 8 of the reporter's record at page 244, he went to his assistant. This is the CEO of the company, and asked her to disable the encryption on confidential files. And then he bought a new hard drive to which he downloaded the confidential files so they wouldn't be encrypted. And he expensed that hard drive to us. Just like they expensed the covert meetings for their planning under A Better to their individual. This is the overlay here, Your Honor, but doesn't disrupt the verdicts, is that what the jury was looking at in those 59 pages that I feel like I've been breathing and sleeping for a while, the jury was looking at not just the conduct afterward, but the conduct before. And with respect to the Westlake lead and turning, because I want to be mindful of time, to the speculative nature, if there was speculative nature of the damages award. I think the jury was well charged here, because what you saw was there was a submission for lost profits, and we did make an argument for lost profits, and the jury awarded nothing. The jury looked at our expert, at Mr. Balcombe's testimony, at his report and conclusions, and determined there hadn't been a lost client. But when they looked at the Westlake evidence, particularly because what you see the executive defendants, as I'll call them in shorthand, when you see what they did, they took the individual that they all knew did not have a non-compete. That would be Mr. Pachacki. And if you listen to the way that they talk about him in as a strategy tool, Your Honors, the two things you have not heard from appellant, and I am sure you will not hear, is that this information wasn't confidential. The information on the hard drive, the information regarding forecasts, our modeling, it's confidential. And you've heard them complain about the court's definition of fiduciary responsibilities, complete scrupulous honesty, putting the company's interests ahead of your own. And of course, they're going to complain about that because when you look at what they said in those, and I'm talking specifically now about Mr. Palis's emails where he addresses the use of Mr. Pachacki. He says things like, this will be a gut punch to Horizon. If the people of Horizon, if we have Pachacki, if it's Horizon's people, then Horizon is dead. And then, unfortunately, he says things, and there's reference made to F Horizon or effing Horizon in those emails while he is working for Horizon.
I understand the emotional nature of that, but let's get back to the speculative nature of the damages because that is their major argument.
Yes, Your Honor.
What is your response to that?
The response to that is that what we know is that the lead was there, that Mr. Pachacki took it with him. We knew that he emailed it to his personal email account the day that he left. He then, with the co-defendants, on the evidence in the record is replete on this, used the modeling they had. Part of it came from that hard drive. Part of it came from other confidential information to put together, in short order, a proposal that allowed them to compete, in their words, head-to-head with Horizon very shortly after his departure. That was the first prong is whether or not Westlake was a lead and whether that was something we could attack. In terms of the speculative nature, and Your Honor's question about, well, if the agreement only lasts for a year, then how do we project damages? And the question there is whether or not Mr. Balcombe presented legally sufficient evidence that the effect of that contract, because of the term of the contract and the relationship being built there, could give rise to damages in the future. And he tempered that opinion. He did not say, I believe they're going to keep this contract. You'll see that he actually diminished the future loss damages, for example, in year 10, which was the intellectually honest approach, which the jury accepted, because they were looking at, but for the pirating of the information and but for the pirating of Mr. Pachacki and that lead, then would the contract have been awarded in all probability to Horizon? And for that, I turn Your Honor to Mr. Palis's own words in that string of emails where he says, we are the core and the brain of Horizon. And he later says, the people and the information they found at Horizon, I think he says the people of Horizon are now the people of Acadia. So the nature of the damages, the same people who went and won that contract are the people who were at Horizon.
But the entire damages amount was not based solely on Westlake. It was also based upon these two other clients that they were going to get that they wouldn't have gotten had they not had Mr. Pachacki, correct?
That's true, Your Honor. And that goes again to Mr. Pachacki's Mr. Pachacki, I believe, defined himself as probably someone who was in the top 90% of what he did. We know that at the time, the individuals, particularly Mr. Ulasewicz, who was bound also by the non-solicit provision, were actively planning a way to solicit Mr. Pachacki, and that would be why. Because, and you notice that we did not go after all of the five contracts that were signed afterward, because that wouldn't have been a legally honest position to take or a technically honest position to take based on the discovery that we ultimately got. What we were able to do before the jury, and I think what the record demonstrates, is that not only was there a legally sufficient basis for those damages, but there was also a factually sufficient basis to tie the entire plan together. That first, we're going to, early on, if we can't buy this business ourselves, and there's no question that Project Shamrock was what the defendants below wished to do. Project Shamrock was their dream. When that fell through, they immediately began making plans to get out from under Horizon. They attempted to solicit Mr. Thomas, who was Mr. Thompson, who was in the financial division, and he said, "I don't want to do anything against Horizon," and so they continued without him. But they had those meetings. They had the gall to charge us for those meetings, and without being unduly emotional about it, they then took, you know, the information that they took on a hard drive. The argument made by appellant seems to suggest that one of the reasons the non-competes are unenforceable is because the parties moved to a higher level of responsibility. And actually, Your Honors, that they're indicted by their own logic there. It's the confidential information is the key here.
I have one more question that actually has to do with the attorney's fees.
Yes,
ma'am. And that is, do you have any case that says that appellate attorney's fees should be segregated?
Your Honor, I do not have a case that specifically says that attorney's fees, that I can think of on my feet, that say that attorney's fees should be segregated. And in fact, I'm not certain how one would do that. I can't imagine, if I were called upon to do that in this case for my appellate fees, I think I would have to just fall on my sword and say, I'm sorry, mainly because of the overlap of issues that we've discussed here today.
But Your Honor, the trial court awarded a segregated amount of the appellate attorney's fees that were testified to.
Yes, Your Honor, that's true. I think it was based on an estimate of what the trial court, what Mr. Vidal assumed the cost would be going forward, you know, based on the best opinion. We obviously take issue on cross appeal with the award of fees. Thank you, Your Honors, if you have no other questions.
All right, thank you, Ms. Lovett. Mr. Nobles, rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'd like to really talk about three things. Our reply brief at page 3 details the documents that Acadia says shows that the Westlake contract was a lead, and I'll stand on our brief on that. But I will point out that if there were any question about whether Westlake was a lead or not, it doesn't reside on a hard drive or anywhere. It resides in doing discovery and asking that question. All the argument about conversations about Westlake and all this stuff that was done about Westlake, none of it is of record. It's argument based on a forensic examination of emails. And the emails that Acadia cites in its brief, they don't say what Acadia says they say. It doesn't say that Westlake was a lead. The testimony of Mr. Devaney, who's here today, was that I was mistaken. Westlake was not a lead at the time these folks left. Y'all asked, and I think it was you, Judge Walker, who asked, what effect, it may have been all three of you actually, what effect does the, I know it was you, Judge Gabriel, does the effect that the difference in the Ulasewicz covenant not to compete, what effect does that have on the outcome of the case? Here's the answer to that. His covenant to not to compete says that he can only not compete as to accounts listed on a master account list. It's undisputed that he didn't do that. Whether he took trade secrets or not is a hotly disputed fact in this case. I'll stand on my brief on the issue of liability for trade secrets. But the jury finding of the value of the trade secrets was at most $50,000. It was asked that question three times. Twice it said the value of the trade secrets is zero. The third time it says $50,000. I don't know what you do with that other than remand for a new trial. We wouldn't want to try this case over $50,000 again. We've already spent too much time on this case and way too much treasure on it.
What about Mr. Ulasewicz's covenant not to solicit?
In his covenant not to solicit, it can't reach lost profits that aren't related to customers that were not existing customers. The damage model for future lost profits only deals with hypothetical customers never identified at all by anyone. They're hypothetical customers that did not yet belong to Horizon, and the business model, the damages model necessarily depended on those being non-existing customers that might come into existence in the future. That is not a reasonable covenant not to compete. Very similar to the covenant that this court decided in the Gooden case was overbroad and unenforceable. No matter how you try to create a lost profits recovery in this case, you can't do it fundamentally under Texas law because it is not a protectable interest that Horizon had in customers that it did not already have. We've been saying this every way we know to say it, but Horizon did not lose a customer. Because it did not lose a customer, it did not suffer future lost profit damages to a protectable interest. It did not have a fact of damage. It had an expert who testified about calculations based on hypothetical assumptions. I want to leave the court with a record site. Reporter's Record 10 is the testimony of the expert witness at page 183 and at page 196. The expert testified that Pachocki did not cause Horizon to lose any business. Their theory is that they would have had more business in the future with Mr. Pachocki there. But that's Mr. Pachocki's talent. That's not a property interest, a protectable interest, or a fact of damage that Horizon showed in this case. We'd ask that the court reverse and render on these issues, or alternatively reverse and remand. And we thank you very much for your time today. Thank you.
All right, thank you, Mr. Nobles. Ms. Leavitt, all of counsel, we appreciate all of your hard work on this case. We appreciate your briefing and your arguments today and for coming over to Fort Worth. Your case is now submitted, and we will excuse court since we have no further cases on this morning's docket.
All right.